The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening, the second day of July. I'll be taking you through the first hour of Sports Talk 1240. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is right across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. The legendary Dave Mason will be with us. In the second half, we'll return to Baseball at the Movies and speak to author Richard Sandomir about his new book, Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some good stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is a singer, songwriter, and guitarist from Worcester, England. First found fame with the rock band Traffic. Over the course of his career, he's played and recorded with many notable pop and rock musicians, including Mr. McCartney, Mr. Harrison, The Stones, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, Michael Jackson, David Crosby, Graham Nash, Steve Winwood, Fleetwood Mac, and Delaney and Bonnie, not to mention Cass Elliott. And in 2004, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a founding member of Traffic. He will be appearing at the Great South Bay Music Festival at Shorefront Park in Patchogue on July 16th. I'd like to welcome to the show tonight Dave Mason. Dave, good evening.
Hey, good evening. How are you?
Great to have you with us, Dave. It's a real honor. Now, let's talk about some of your early influences musically, Dave.
Well, they would be probably mostly just instrumental bands, since guitar was my first passion.
Okay.
So they would be obviously things like The Ventures and Duane Eddy, Chet Atkins, but mostly an English band Americans don't really know, because they were huge all over the world.
Okay.
Much far east, Australia, all over Europe with The Shadows. So those were my first influences.
Okay, now, you wanted to join the Royal Air Force when you were young, too, didn't you?
Yep, that was what I really wanted.
Interesting. What made you want to join the RAF, Dave?
Oh, just a passion for flying.
Yeah.
And, but unfortunately, my math skills weren't up to par, so I got a guitar and found a new way to fly.
Yeah, you sure did, yeah. Now, let's talk about the Traffic days a little bit disjointed there. You co-founded the group, but you left following the recording of Mr. Fantasy back in 67, and you came back during the sessions for the next album. Let's talk a little bit about the early days with Traffic.
Well, Jim Capaldi and I had bands before Traffic. A band called The Deep Feeling and a group called The Hellions. Made a record with The Hellions for Pi Records, did a Jackie DeShannon song, didn't do anything, but, so Jim and I knew each other, previous to Traffic. And then, Birmingham, which is the largest city in the Midlands, so to speak, it's about 30 miles from Worcester, and we would go there and play gigs, little clubs, mostly pubs. But there was a late night private club, basically, called the Elbow Room up there, that would have music and you could get food there. and we were big Spencer Davis fans anyway. And so that's basically where we pretty much, I think where we pretty much met Steve. And then he had a good friend, Chris Wood, who was really an art student. And we just sort of, when we could, sort of basically kind of just, we would hang out together. You know, we had a lot of wide musical tastes, but all pretty much converged. And which sort of led to, you know, musically we were, I mean, I think Traffic was probably would, I mean, if you have to put a label on it and classify it, I know people could, you know, interviews will say, well, you're that psychedelic band, Traffic. Mm-hmm. And Traffic was never a psychedelic band, ever. If anything, it was would have been one of the original alternate bands. We incorporated so much of different, you know, country, blues, gospel, R&B, rock, pop. So we incorporated it all.
You did.
And then we did, and so I was, I actually spent 3 months playing roadie for the Spencer Davis Group prior to Traffic, so Steve and I could hang out. I had to I had to stand in for him one night at a show that he didn't turn up for. And then I started writing when Traffic formed. And I wrote their first big hit record, which is the first song I'd ever written, called Hole in My Shoe. Traffic at this point really wasn't known over here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big hit in England and Europe. And then basically, after that first album, I left. I left. It was actually it made a big deal about it in the Sunday papers, the national Sunday papers, and it carried a couple of articles about it. But I was just so young. It was all happening too fast for me, and it was a little more than I could handle, and that's why I left.
Sure.
The first time. And during that period, I produced an album for another very alternative band called The Family, Music in a Doll's House, and I got to know Hendrix, and finished up doing some things with it. I was actually going to take Noel Redding's place at one point, but I finished up recording with him, and a couple of things finished up on Electric Ladyland, singing on Crosstown Traffic, and playing the acoustic guitar and his version of All Along the Watchtower.
I was going to ask you about that, Dave. Yeah, I was heading towards Hendrix next.
There were a couple of things in that period. I mean, the other would have been playing on, finish up sitting in on a Beggar's Banquet session playing on Street Fighting Man. And just sort of worked on my songwriting and kind of wondered what the heck I was going to be doing next.
Right. Well, that's some experience to have working with Hendrix and the Stones. Definitely. We're speaking to Dave Mason tonight on Sports Talk 1240. In 69-70, Dave, you toured with Bonnie Bramlett and Delaney and friends, and I guess Eric Clapton and George Harrison as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'd come over to this. I'd been to the U.S. and visited. I mean, I came here when I was I would have been about 11 years old. My sister moved here in the 50s. I'd come over here and musically I would visit, but, through the Stones, I got to know Graham Parsons. And then after, just step back after that, you know, first Traffic album, they were recording they were doing the second album, and I were at the, I believe they were at the Record Plant, if I remember correctly, in New York. And they were working on the album, and they had, and I stopped by the session, since they were there, and they only had five songs. And I had written five tunes during that little break, between the first and second album, one of them being Feeling All Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was back in the band.
Yeah.
At that point. But after, finally afterwards, and then my songs were picked as singles again, and then that sort of created a rift, that made it sort of impossible for me to be part of that band anymore. So I pretty much decided that at that point, I also, it was a brief attempt after Cream broke up. I put a band together with Ginger Baker, and a man named Bobby Gass called Salt. Mm-hmm. But it was just a trio, and it was a little too close to trying to emulate Cream, and it wasn't going to go down that road. And so I thought, well, at this point, I think I'm just going to, the Traffic maybe was kind of just getting known over here in the U.S. Nobody really knew who I was, or nobody knew who I was at all. But I decided that I would just go where all contemporary music started, i.e. the U.S. Because right. That's basically all us English guys did anyway, was we learned from all the American music and copied it and put our own little twist on it and sold it back to you, basically.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, but it all comes from here. So I thought I'd go to the source. And so I moved here, pretty much permanently moved here in 1969. And Graham Parsons, I spent with him for a month or so, and I got to know a group called Delaney and Bonnie.
Right.
Great band, great musicians, in 69 I cut my first solo album Alone Together, which came out in January 1970. And never had a hit record off it. I had a minor hit record with a song called Only You Know and I Know, which Delaney and Bonnie covered, and they had a number two record with it. But the album Alone Together just sort of went on. I guess it just sort of was an album that just it sold a lot of albums over the years. And so I went on the road with Delaney and Bonnie for a little while, which opened for Blind Faith, which is kind of how most of Delaney and Bonnie's band finished up being Derek and the Dominoes.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Now, you also appeared on Harrison's All Things Must Pass.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Interesting.
I got into playing sitar when I was with Traffic. Originally, I used it on a couple of things. And George gave me a sitar to work on. So I knew them a little bit. I knew McCartney from a woman I was dating at the time who was a designer, who was designing some furniture for McCartney. And it wasn't unusual for people to drop by each other's sessions back, you know, in London, because mm-hmm. basically that's where everybody was, or would finish up, and that's where the studios were. It was very easy to get, i.e. to know people like the Stones, McCartney, Harrison, Hendrix, because we were all in the same place.
Right, yeah, and you could just drop by, like you said, in each other's sessions, and some great things took place. You were slated, Dave, to be the second guitarist for Derek and the Dominoes at one point.
I was with them at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I started recording with them, and it's, which is not public knowledge, but it's sort of at that time it was, Eric was, unfortunately through Jim Gordon, the drummer, had gotten involved in heroin, and there were a lot of down days where nothing was being done. So I kind of finished up just going, you know what, guys, I got to go do something. So I up and came back to the U.S.
Right. And Dave Mason was replaced by a gentleman by the name of Dwayne Allman.
Yeah, they made a great album.
Yeah, and that became the Layla Sessions, I guess, after that. And as the rest, they say, is history. Now, you worked with Michael Jackson. I found that very interesting, Dave. Can you give us a little insight into what that was like?
Well, I was cutting the last album I ever did for Columbia.
Okay.
Old Crest on a New Wave. I can't remember, studio in L.A. But Michael was in the other room. It wasn't Thriller. I don't think he was doing Thriller. It was one of the other albums. Anyway, one of the other very big albums that he had. But he was working in there with Quincy Jones. And I had a song that was on my, that I was cutting called Save Me.
Mm-hmm.
That I needed a high harmony on it. And so I was like, well, shit, Michael's over here in the other studio. I'll go ask him if he'd mind coming and singing this harmony part. So I walked over there. They were on a break, and he was standing in the doorway of the studio, actually. And I was like, hi, Michael, I'm Dave Mason. I'm working over here. I don't know how you feel about it, but I got this song, and I'd be really honored if you'd come sing a little bit on it. I need a high part. And he looked at me and said, you know what? He said, when I was 12 years old, I did this TV special with Diana Ross. And he said, the last song we did on that show was a song called Feeling All Right. So, yeah, absolutely I'll come sing.
Wow. Great story. Oh, boy. So, yeah, then I guess that worked out pretty well for you. And you also did a duet in 88 with Phoebe Snow, which I found interesting as well.
I did. I played on Phoebe's. I actually did something on her, if I'm not mistaken, I think I did something on her album, Poetry Man. I'm pretty sure I did something. But yes, we did. Phoebe and I did a song together. It was on a Two Hearts album.
Yeah, the reached number 11 on the U.S. charts, which not too bad.
Yeah.
And another thing I found very intriguing, Dave Mason with us tonight, is that you joined Fleetwood Mac and Company in 1995.
Yeah. 94, 96.
Okay.
Was when I joined. Mick, who I knew, came to me and said, you know, Stevie and Lindsay are kind of... Then I'm not interested in doing anything, and I'm thinking of putting a version of the Mac back together, and would you be interested? And I was like, well, you know what? Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Give it a shot. So we toured quite a bit and did an album called Time, which unfortunately didn't get really promoted very well by Warner Brothers. So it sort of kind of fell by the wayside.
Yeah.
I think more Warners did it more for trying to pressure them into putting their original lineup back together, which happened, which is a good thing.
Which it did, exactly. Now, getting back to Traffic a little bit, Dave, They were really always about the music, Traffic. The album-oriented rock was hot back then, but yeah, it was more about the music than the commercial appeal with Traffic, wasn't it?
Well, it was collectively. I mean, it's always about the music for me, but I have somewhat of a pop sensibility. I mean, mm-hmm. I like a hook.
Yeah.
I like a, I like a hook. I like a melody. I like a good line. That's kind of why I have very diverse musical taste, but I can't quite get my head around rap. But if I can't whistle it or hum it, it ain't music to me. So, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, what would you consider your greatest memory or your greatest thrill in your illustrious career?
Oh God, you just rattled off a bunch of them at the beginning of the show.
Yeah. Working with all those folks?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't pick any one. I mean, if I had to pick one, I suppose it'd be Hendrix.
Yeah, well, what was it like working with Jimmy, Dave?
What do you think?
Out of this world.
I ought to find a different instrument to play, because this guy's just, he was just very innovative.
Yeah.
That's the thing about Hendrix. I mean, there's a lot of great guitar players out there. A lot of great ones. I mean, I think Joe Bonamassa is probably one of my favorites.
Right.
But there are no more Hendrixes.
No. And
no more Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, definitely. And you worked with him down on, I guess it was West 8th Street, Electric Ladyland.
No. People will think it's there and here and there. He may have done some remixing there, but Watchtower and Grosstown Traffic were cut at Olympic Studios in London.
Ah, okay. Yeah, so that's where.
Trust me, I should know. I was there.
Yeah,
I played
exactly,
on it.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Now, you've done a lot of live performances. You're still out on the road, as we know. You'll be out here on the island. Do you have any memorable performance that sticks out in your mind for whatever reason?
I try to make them all memorable.
Okay.
If it ain't fun, you know, to play. I mean, I love playing, and so do the musicians in my band. We are essentially working musicians, and we spend that whole day just to get to a place where we can spend an hour and a half just making some great music, mostly for ourselves, you know. And hopefully audiences enjoy that. I mean, it's all about the music. There's no show. It never has been with me. I mean, we don't have any dance steps, and we don't have any pyrotechnics.
Right.
We don't have any scantily dressed women up there.
You don't set yourself on fire or anything.
And we don't set ourselves on fire. We just play great songs and just play great music is what we strive to do.
You do, and you're also involved in a lot of philanthropy, Dave, a lot of charity work with children, veterans. Give us a little insight into that, what's happening these days.
Well, mostly I'm pretty much just involved in my charity work that I try to do for vets, which also encompasses also law enforcement, firemen, and we just try to it's called Rock Our Vets, with a friend of mine, Ted Knapp, who lives out there in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And we just try to, you know, do what we can to help supply things that they may need, just basic stuff, clothes, a computer, a car, just whatever help we can give.
Fine. Yeah, very, very good. Now, as we said, Dave and the band will be at the Great South Bay Music Festival down here in Patchogue, Shorefront Park down in Patchogue, Sunday, July 16th. The guys take the stage at 6 p.m. And yep. You familiar with Long Island, Dave?
Long Island, hey.
Everyone
knows. I used to play. For years, when I was out there, would play a little tiny place out there called Stephen Talk House.
Yeah, out in the Hamptons. Yeah, still there.
Yep. Yeah, I know it's still there.
Yeah.
I was. Peter wanted me to come and do their 50th anniversary show, but unfortunately, because I'm playing the festival, it's sort of. They weren't too happy about me going playing somewhere else.
Yeah.
So close. No, well, I don't know why it would have made much difference. The place only holds 120 people.
Yeah, right.
So it's very small.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, Dave, it's been an honor and a pleasure getting you on the show, finally speaking with you, and I thank you for spending part of your Sunday night with us.
Oh, my pleasure, and thank you.
You take care, Dave. Dave Mason, folks. Next up,
thank you.
We'll talk to author Richard Sandomir. His book about Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the great movie Pride of the Yankees. So stick around, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. We've got another half hour to go. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. My next guest is an award-winning sports media and sports business writer for the New York Times. His latest book is titled The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. I welcome to the show tonight Richard Sandomir.
Glad to be here.
Richard, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. How are you?
Doing okay. I just wish the Mets would have swept the Phillies today, but the season's not going according to my plans anyway, so it really doesn't matter at this point. But let's excuse me, let's get down to brass tacks. This book is sensational, and every baseball fan has seen Pride of the Yankees, and it's a great idea for the book, Richard. How did you come up with the idea that you wanted to do this project, tackle this particular piece?
Well, I'd been intrigued by the speech for the luckiest man speech for a long time, both the original by Lou Gehrig and the one that Gary Cooper delivered in Pride of the Yankees, and it just developed more and more into an overall fascination with the movie, and then a fascination with finding original materials from the movie, scripts and stuff like that. And once I was able to get into the Samuel Goldwyn archive in Beverly Hills, that's where the book was made. Scripts, letters, correspondence, anything I could want. 75% of the book is based on the research in there, and it's just, you know, everything I could want and more was in there.
That was the mother lode, so to speak.
It was. I mean, when you see the notes of the interviews that Eleanor Gehrig gave to the first scriptwriter, who was Paul Gallico, who had fairly recently left as the sports editor and sports columnist for the Daily News, and later far better known for writing The Poseidon Adventure. But Eleanor sat down for a couple of weeks with Gallico, and Gallico wrote the outline for the movie and the first script, and then contributed along the way after that. It was she basically spilled her guts and her heart about her life with Lou, her life before Lou, and her feelings about Lou's mother, which were not very pleasant.
Right, yeah, which the movie makes it out to be a kind of a chilly relationship, but that's not the half of it, as we'll find out. Now, it's also the 75th anniversary of the film. People may not know, 75 years ago that movie was made. Now, unlike today's atmosphere, Richard, where the athletes are under the microscope 24/7, they can't make a move without people knowing about it. Due to the movie, Gary Cooper turned out to be more Lou Gehrig than Lou Gehrig was.
Well, yeah, certainly to some extent, certainly because of the scarcity of newsreel footage of Gehrig, far less of Gehrig than there is of Ruth. Not a whole lot of Ruth, but far more of Ruth than Gehrig. We don't get to see much of Lou Gehrig in action, the real
right.
Lou Gehrig. So for a little over 2 hours, we see Gary Cooper as Lou Gehrig. Not a whole lot of action because he had to learn how to play baseball. But this was never going to be a baseball movie. It was always going to be a movie about a courageous man who happened to play baseball and the romance with Eleanor. That's the way Samuel Goldwyn wanted it, because he had no idea what baseball was.
Exactly. And we'll delve into that a little bit more, too, folks. That's a fact. Now, the movie, Richard, it's a kind of a pioneer in a genre that barely existed previously.
Yeah, I say it's the greatest movie, greatest sports movie of, you know, up till then. There wasn't a whole lot of competition, but it was still the greatest sports movie for a while after that. But, you know, you had Knute Rockne, All-American. You had The Champ with Wallace Beery and Jackie Cooper. You had, Joey Brown comic baseball movies. And Horse Feathers, which really was a very good parody of college sports amateurism, just delivered as a Marx Brothers comedy. So and I'm sure there was more that I could mention, but it was not a genre as it became in the 70s and 80s. So here you have Pride of the Yankees, which, again, a very early, based on a true story, biopic, that is coming out, that a deal was made between Goldwyn and Eleanor Gehrig within 6 weeks of Lou dying. The movie starts production in February of 42, and it comes out in July of 42, barely a year and a month after Lou's death. So, yeah, it was a very quick turnaround, and it very quickly became the best sports movie made.
For sure. Now, Samuel Goldwyn, as we'll be talking about further during our conversation, more interested in making a love story that would appeal to a female audience rather than a film about baseball.
Yeah, because that's what he knew.
He had a
strong gut about what would appeal to a broad audience, and that meant families and women. And again, here's a Polish immigrant who comes to America, goes to work in the glove factories in upstate New York of actually Gloversville, then finds his way into New York where he gets into the movies and he becomes one of the great independent movie producers. And baseball and sports was not part of his American assimilation experience, as it is for many immigrants. So by the time it was suggested that he make a baseball movie, he said, you know, you want baseball? Go to the ballpark. It's box office poison.
Right.
Part of that was his ignorance about baseball, which he thought was played with maybe 12 bases. But part of it was just a smart instinct that he'd be a pioneer in making a movie like this and in making a baseball movie, per se. If this were 75% baseball, it probably would have died. actors weren't playing baseball back then, or at least none that could play it as well as, say, Kevin Costner.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, he didn't know anything about baseball. Gary Cooper had never played baseball. Teresa Wright had never gone to a baseball game. And the cinematographer had never shot a, had never been to a baseball game either. So, you know, the default was to do a movie about a courageous man who dies young and the woman and the love story about Lou and Eleanor. That was what he saw. That's what he recognized. That's what he instinctively understood he had to do.
Right. Now, we're speaking to Richard Sandomir tonight on Sports Talk 1240 about the pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, et cetera. Now, Eleanor Gehrig, Richard, was a real stickler for facts, dates, particular games, wasn't she?
Yeah. She, you know, one of the things that is very accurate about the portrayal by Teresa Wright of her in the movie is that she was a baseball fan, she understood baseball, and certainly she learned a lot more about baseball living with Lou. So she would, during the shooting of the movie and a little bit before, send letters to Goldwyn or to Goldwyn through her agent, Christy Walsh, with a list of 10 or 12 different points that she wanted to make. For instance, she said, look, you can have Lou's parents attending our wedding, but that's not true. They were not there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have Miller Huggins in a suit signing Lou Gehrig to a contract in an office, but that's not true. It didn't happen that way. She said, you can't have Lou hit four home runs in a World Series game. Now, did she win all of her things, all her points? No, she lost most of them. But if you think there's a victory in there, well, instead of four home runs in a World Series game, he promised little Billy with the polio in the hospital two home runs in a World Series game. Not true, but better than promising four.
Right.
So, yeah, she didn't want sports writers and other baseball aficionados to say that the life of Lou Gehrig had been Hollywoodized.
Right.
Of course it
rightfully
was.
So. Good thinking on her part.
But
yeah.
She was during his life, during their marriage, and even more so afterwards, the guardian of his legacy. If you go to the Hall of Fame, you can ask to see the scrapbooks that she made of his life, meticulous, beautiful-looking scrapbooks that have needed to be preserved since then. And then Goldwyn and his people made a prop scrapbook, which looks okay on film, but when you look up close, instead of the meticulously glued on or taped on articles, you'd see a picture, a relevant picture of Cooper as Gehrig, or Teresa Wright and Cooper in a shot. But the article attached to it would be about snow removal or a vote in a zoning board.
Right.
You couldn't see it on camera, so it didn't matter. They just plopped it on there.
Okay. Now, there's an inaccuracy of Lou giving way to Babe Dahlgren in the movie. Now, Babe Dahlgren ended up negotiating himself right out of the picture, didn't he?
Yeah, well, that's more Tony Lazzari than it was Dahlgren. But
okay.
Back to, you know, Dahlgren, in real life, Lou Gehrig approached Joe McCarthy in the hotel in Detroit and said, I can't go on anymore, in May 2nd, 1939. In the movie, they have Lou walking back to the dugout in the sixth inning, saying, I can't go on any further. And you'd already seen him sort of, you know, flexing his fingers, and you sense that, you know, he knew something was wrong with them. And so he removes himself from the lineup, and Joe McCarthy puts in Babe Dahlgren. You know, dramatic license is there. But what happened with Dahlgren is that, you know, Sam Goldwyn did not want a whole lot of former recurring Yankees in the movie. He wanted to limit it. He hired Christy Walsh, also Eleanor's agent, to be the Yankee wrangler. And he was negotiating with a few of them. He knew he had to have a few. and he never approached Dahlgren, and Dahlgren threatened to go to Commissioner Landis to say, you know, you're not going to use my name without paying me. You're not going to have some actor do this, blah, blah, blah. And Goldman did exactly that. He hired somebody to, you know, give him three words in a line. And, you know, Dahlgren apparently got a few hundred bucks for his troubles, according to his grandson. But, yeah, Lazzari's, I think the blame fell to Lazzari's wife for asking more than Goldman was willing to pay. He was,
yeah.
Goldman did not want to pay a lot of money for these players, and he probably paid a little bit more for Bill Dickey, who had a speaking role. And Dickey truly was Gary's closest friend and former roommate, and they really got along well. And in fact, for a while, Dickey did not want to be in the movie because he felt it would be terribly awkward to address anybody but Lou as Lou, so it would have been tough for him to talk to Cooper and think of him as Lou Gehrig.
Right, great point, great point. Talking about the iconic speech, Richard, the classic line, "I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth." It was moved to the end of the speech for the movie. Now, I grew up myself thinking that's where the line fell, and that's not the case at all.
No, I mean, everything that I've discovered is that this was at the beginning of the speech. And, you know, it starts off with, you know, for the last few weeks you've heard about a bad break. But
right.
Today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Well, the original version, although we don't, I'm not certain there ever truly was a written speech. But the version that Eleanor has for all these years said was official is a little less than 300 words. And he thanks a lot of people in there. He thanks his parents. He thanks his mother-in-law. He thanks the New York Giants. He thanks his managers. He thanks his wife. He thanks a few other people in there. He thanks Ed Barrow, the Yankees president and dynasty builder. Well, the speech that was finally written by Herman Mankiewicz and Joe Swerling was a little less than 200 words, and it thanked fewer people. Eleanor was adamant that she wanted Cooper's version to include thanks to Barrow. That didn't come about.
Right.
So she lost a good number of her battles, but I think she kind of just kept everybody on notice, saying, "I'm watching you." And but the speech, you know, Gehrig did not go up to the microphone with anything in hand, which raises to me a question of, here's a guy who didn't deliver speeches, who lived and played in the shadow of Ruth. Ruth could be extemporaneous about anything, but that was not Lou's thing. So Eleanor told various stories about how the speech came about. They worked on it together. He worked on it alone. He rehearsed it. He didn't rehearse it. It's kind of confusing. And maybe they made some notes, but in all the things that she preserved, and she preserved a lot of stuff and donated it to the Hall of Fame, there is no copy of a speech. She told Goldwyn, "Here's a copy of it. Here's what Lou said. I've written it down from memory. I want Gary Cooper to say it the same way."
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, if she wrote it down from memory, then maybe it's not quite as maybe it's not any more accurate than the versions that than the accounts that the reporters wrote down in their stories a day later. There's a lot of differences. In one version, he thanked Dickey. You know, we don't know because the original newsreel is only about four lines remain.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole thing is the other 30 or 40 lines, they're gone. We don't know why the newsreel doesn't exist anymore or if it's hiding somewhere, but, you know, that would be the only true record. Not Eleanor's memory, that would be the only true record of everything. And that's probably in part why the Cooper version of the speech in the movie is really the one that people remember. And
exactly,
he delivered
yeah.
it awfully well, and that's another reason why it's remembered, because he delivered it in the style of an actor who was used to playing men of quiet dignity.
Definitely. Great point, Richard. Speaking of Yankees who are in the film, of course, everybody remembers Babe Ruth, and he had to lose 50 pounds for that movie, which must have been a real chore for the Bambino. And Eleanor Gehrig didn't want Babe in the film at all.
No, she felt that Lou, having played in the shadow for so long of Ruth, she didn't want Gary Cooper as playing her husband be in the shadow of Ruth. So she was afraid he was going to steal scenes. She didn't want it. At best, she said, you know, make sure he doesn't have any solo scenes, which I don't think he has. But I think in her heart of hearts, she knew that Ruth was important to the movie. He was basically the third star. Right after Teresa Wright and Gary Cooper, there was Ruth, there was Walter Brennan.
Right.
And if you're a movie buff, then Walter Brennan is the third star. But, you know, in a movie without a whole lot of baseball, Ruth was a reminder of great baseball. And even at 47 years old, he was still able to swing like Babe Ruth and once in a while connect like Babe Ruth. He lost the 50 pounds, and unfortunately it took so much out of him that for about 2 weeks during the shooting, he was hospitalized with pneumonia. The other thing that he was hospitalized for, your listeners may recall, there's a scene where the Yankees are celebrating winning the World Series, and they're in a train car, and everything looks very rambunctious, and Ruth himself, I don't think he's acting this way. I think he was out of control. He may have had a few too many drinks, and there's a scene, a very tight close-up on him, where I've run that over and over. I can't understand what language he's speaking there. So he may have been rambunctious and drunk, and he bashed the glass window of the train car with his hand and got all bloodied. He broke some blood vessels, and he was hospitalized for a little while for that. That was pretty much towards the end of filming, so he wasn't needed that much more. But he was a major presence. He was doing a lot of charity work in Los Angeles during the filming. He wasn't needed all the time, but he lent an air of verisimilitude to a movie where Gary Cooper had to learn how to play baseball.
Right.
Lefty O'Doul, the former National League batting champion.
Exactly, and where, you know, I was going next, Richard.
Okay.
Yeah. Gary Cooper has to look like a ball player. He doesn't swing well. Of course, he's right-handed. He doesn't swing well left-handed at all. And they contact the great hitter Lefty O'Doul to teach him a thing or two.
Yeah, one of the things he teaches him is that, you know, hey Coop, you know how to swing an axe. You trap, you know, that you can do. Well, swinging an axe left-handed is not that far from swinging a bat. So he had all these things, you know, in order to teach him to throw left-handed, he had him, you know, toss pebbles. And, you know, so, look, one of the things that was to Cooper's advantage as a 40-year-old novice at baseball was that he didn't have to unlearn any bad habits. But he wasn't naturally a baseball player. So after 6 weeks, he looked, in my mind, okay. Again, for 6 weeks of instruction, and at, you know, at Brentwood, where in the back five or six acres of the backyard of Cooper's home, and in Sun Valley, where he is, Idaho, where he had a home. The hardest thing people tell me to do when you're switching natural hand to your less dominant hand is to learn to throw. And if there is any truth to the legend that Cooper had failed so much to switch to a left-hander that he did everything right-handed and they flipped the film, which has been somewhat, to my mind, disproven, there is ample evidence that in the very brief scenes where he's throwing during the minor league montage where Gehrig is playing in Hartford, it is very obvious that they flipped the film. But his left-handed swinging, if everything was flipped, as a Hall of Fame expert told me, you'd have to do, it's a very elaborate thing. He'd have to swing left-handed, he'd have to swing right-handed and run to third base. You'd have to make sure the shadows look credible because you're kind of flipping the stadium.
Right.
Everybody who has something written on the front of their uniform would have to have that flipped. Their numbers would have to be flipped. Everybody would be running, you know, the opposite way
where they should be. Right, yeah.
And this Hall of Fame expert, a guy named Tom Schieber, said that, you know, one of the telltale signs of flipping that would have been the buttons, the position of the buttons and the plackets where the buttons on the shirts are embedded. And in his mind, in his analysis, frame by frame, that did not happen. So it's a bit of a legend that was perpetuated by Cooper, by the film's editor, but not by Goldman's number two guy, Jim Mulvey, who denied that it all happened. So a lot of people accepted it, and it's still sort of the fable of the movie, but based on the final cut, it does not appear that very much was flipped. And I think, you know, there's a scene in sort of the World's Fair where Lou and Eleanor are on their first date, and he's in an arcade hitting baseballs in a cage. That right. is his best hitting. He has a very nice swing, and he's connecting. I don't think there's any evidence that he connected with a ball in the rest of the movie. And for long shots, that wasn't even Cooper. That was Babe Herman, the former Brooklyn Dodgers star.
Okay. Now, another nugget from the book, Richard, is that the Sporting News readers nominated 44 men to play Garrigan. They included John Wayne, Ronald Reagan, Lionel Barrymore, and George Tobias, who people will remember as Abner Kravitz from Bewitched. Of course, yeah, Abner didn't make the cut.
He didn't make the cut. Well, this whole notion of, you know, searching for an actor to play Lou Gehrig was public relations fol-de-rol. Luella Parsons, the great gossip queen, had suggested it to Goldwyn, and Goldwyn may have thought of something on his own like that. But, you know, Vivian Leigh was chosen to play Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind based on a real search. Here, this was a publicity ploy. And for many people, the most curious name on the list of both actors and athletes is Eddie Albert. Now, Eddie Albert is known to most of us baby boomers as Oliver Wendell Douglas,
right.
Green Acres, the lawyer who goes to work. He buys a farm, and he goes, you know, on his tractor in a suit and a tie, and it's all very funny. And but Eddie Albert was a pretty good actor, and some people thought he should be there, be playing Lou, because he had dimples like Lou. The most ardent supporter for a brief time was Ed Barrow, the Yankees president, who was a big Eddie Albert fan. And Albert was fairly early in his career, so he was of the right age. He was a little younger than Cooper, and he lived to be like 99. But Cooper was in the last year of his the last picture of his contract with Goldwyn. There was nobody in Hollywood any better than he. I guess you could imagine Fonda or Jimmy Stewart in that role. None of them, who I would imagine, were great at baseball, although Stewart did play Monty Stratton in the Stratton story.
Exactly, right, yeah.
So, but at that time, it didn't matter if an actor couldn't play an athletic role that well. There weren't people examining those things back then. And if you saw a movie a couple of times, you may never see it again. There was no afterlife until television came along. So people didn't have time to criticize it, and it was only a year after Lou died, and I think people were looking at this very quickly as a Gary Cooper movie, and Gary Cooper knew how to play characters like this, and that's why he's remembered so fondly, not because of his baseball skills, but because of the speech and because of the love story that he and Teresa Wright so ably acted out.
Right. Now, the premiere of the movie, which was, as we remember, the summer of 1942, it was the last major premiere in Hollywood until after World War II.
Yeah. You know, it first showed in New York. There was a big premiere in New York. But when it went to Hollywood, remember, this was August 42, 9 months into our involvement in the war, and the government had basically said no more big-time Hollywood premieres because all those big spotlights and Klieg lights were considered a danger for fear of an enemy attack on the West Coast. So it would be until after the war that, you know, they'd go back to normal with the premieres. So this was the last one, and it brought out a huge amount of stars, as most premieres did. This was a big, lavish thing. You know, it was, once the receipts were totaled up, it was Goldwyn's most successful movie to this point.
Yeah, rightfully so, too. You were in Cooperstown recently at the author series, I saw, Richard.
Yep.
And I wish I could have made it up for that. How was your chat with my buddy Bruce Markison?
It was lovely. You know, they have a nice little theater there.
They do a nice job, right, yeah.
Yeah, they do it nicely. And, you know, the 20 or 30 people who were there, not a big crowd, but you know they're interested. If they're in the Hall of Fame, they're interested. And there was this lovely older man, must be in his late 70s, early 80s, who maybe was the only one there who had read the book. And when I faltered a little bit, he filled in a blank.
Yeah, great.
He was terrific. He remembered it and retained it quite nicely. So
beautiful.
If I have another book, that's worthy of being... my being invited there, I would definitely do it again. It was it's always great to be in Cooperstown.
Definitely. Now, quickly, Richard, your favorite story about the film from the book.
Oh gosh, well, my favorite stuff was finding out from that one particular document that Eleanor didn't want Ruth in the movie. This is one of the favorites. I was looking through one of the scripts, and if you remember the beginning of the movie, there's a sandlot game played by young Lou Gehrig, who was about 12 years old, with similarly aged friends in a sandlot somewhere in Manhattan. And in the script marked final, but it clearly was not the final script, as the ball is pitched to Lou, the pitcher transforms into Christy Mathewson. The sandlot turns into the Polo Grounds, and Lou's the home run that we see that smashes into a storekeeper's window actually is a World Series winning home run, and he's carried aloft on his teammate's shoulders, and he's given the key to the city, and then it fades back into the reality of Lou being in trouble for smashing the storekeeper's window. This came apparently very close to being filmed. They had hired a former ball player named Faye Thomas, mm-hmm. who was a Pacific Coast League favorite. He had a couple of cups of coffee in the major leagues. They had him out to the set. There are pictures of him, one of which I put in the movie and put in the book, where he's in a Giants uniform. But in one of his letters to Eleanor Gehrig, Christy Walsh wrote that Paul Gallico is going to be very upset that scene is not in the movie, but that the director, Sam Wood, had just decided against it. I don't know if they made any attempt at filming it, because there are no outtakes that I could find. So that's one of my favorites, because I'm reading it and I said, now this didn't happen.
Right.
And you know, I'm sure you'll find that in almost every script as a movie evolves, as it's being produced. Scenes that didn't make it, scenes that got filmed, but that got cut out. But the Goldwyn Estate does not have any, does not in its voluminous archive have the outtake. So it's a bit of a mystery to me. There were plans to have a lot more actual retired ball players in there, but I think Goldwyn, if they had advanced very far in that, Goldwyn would have put his foot down. At one point he was willing to cut half of Root's contribution. And, I think his decision-making was correct.
Excellent.
The former ball players who played with Lou just were not going to have much of a role, so why crowd the screen with them?
Wonderful. Well, Richard, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. Baseball at the Movies. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. The book is called Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Book Review in Huntington. Richard Sandomir, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Have a good night. Well, that'll do you it too. For me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Dave Mason and Richard Sandomir, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday night, July 16th. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.